I'll start things off. Roger Leisner, Radio Free Maine. Noam, earlier we had a discussion, and I didn't realize your daughter has been in Nicaragua for almost 15 years now. And a lot has happened in Nicaragua, and of course, back in the 80s, it was one of our, you know, major points in our foreign policy. Have you been to Nicaragua recently? And if so, can you tell us about what the living situations are there, and what is the status of the Sandinista movement now?
Yeah, we go mainly to see friends and see my children, grandchildren mainly. You know, children don't matter at this age. It's the grandchildren you want to see. But so we go. My wife and I were down there a couple months ago. She stayed down for about 10 days. I'd come back. Well, since 1990, the country's going into a tailspin. It's now the second poorest country in the hemisphere. Actually, it's competing with Guatemala for the rank of second poorest country in the hemisphere. The poorest is Haiti, and Nicaragua has fallen to the second level. It's also considered an economic miracle in the normal technical sense. You know, you drive down main streets of Managua, big banks, big supermarkets, stores with flashy, you know, you buy anything you want, and so on. So it's an economic miracle, except for the population, for whom it's now a total disaster. And that's been a very sharp decline since 1990, and a very typical change. In fact, you know, again, it's a real tribute to the educational system in the United States that people are unaware of those correlations. I mean, just take a look at Central America and the Caribbean. That's the region that's been under most U.S. control for a century, obviously. There's one country in the region that sort of functions. It's kind of like a West European social democracy. That's Costa Rica. Also happens to be the one country where the U.S. hasn't intervened. The country in which U.S. intervention has been most is Haiti. Haiti was invaded by Woodrow Wilson in a vicious invasion back in 1915, reinstituted slavery, wiped out the parliamentary system, killed, you know, nobody knows, maybe 20,000 people, ensured that the country would end up in the hands of as a U.S. plantation, left it finally after 20 years in the hands of a brutal National Guard. Then comes an ugly history, which I won't review right up to the moment. So that's the major target of U.S. intervention and the poorest country in the hemisphere. The next two main targets of U.S. intervention in the 20th century are Nicaragua and Guatemala, and they're vying for second place. At the other end, you have one that never had it and happens to sort of function. Furthermore, that pattern generalizes. You know, like ask yourself, what's the basket case of Southeast Asia, the one country that didn't undergo the sort of mixed development story of the past years, and the Philippines, which we've been running pretty much ever since it was conquered 100 years ago, with murdering a couple hundred thousand people. And these patterns generalize. You know, and they're not only true of the United States, you know, like they're true of other imperial powers. Again, it's a real credit to the educational system that this is not in right at the top of everybody's awareness and consciousness. You know, as I say, it's a triumph, kind of like the elections. What happened in Nicaragua is that. It's turned into an economic miracle in which, for most of the population, it's a disaster, and for a small sector, it's very wealthy. If you want to get down there as a tourist, you can go down and stay in a fancy resort, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. If you want to buy a computer, yeah, you buy that. You want a 24-hour service station, that's open. What about the Sandinistas? About what you'd expect. The Sandinista leadership, they came from the elite. They fought. It wasn't fun to be a guerrilla in the hills. But when they took power, they wanted to go back to the elite, and they did. So they are now in a power-sharing arrangement with the other faction, the so-called right-wing government, and most of them, and there's some exceptions, but most of them are living in palaces and doing very well, taking part in the corruption and the robbery and everything else. It's amazing to me that they maintain their, what has been a pretty solid base of support, about 25-30% of the population. I don't understand it, frankly. the good thing, you could see anybody who was down there in the 80s knew this, and I know a lot of you were. The good thing you could say about the Sandinista leadership was that they were not brutal toward the population. Like, it was the one country of Central America where you didn't have to be scared of the police and the army because they weren't going to kill everybody. That was where the U.S. was running it. You did have to be scared. But they kind of left people alone. And they left people with space to do things. So there were various groups that really did things. Some of them some of them kind of left-wing, some of them right-wing. I remember being taken by my close friend of mine there, my best friend actually was the rector of the Catholic University, the Jesuit University, a well-known Central American Jesuit, who took me to a project that was run by an order of nuns. I forget the name, but it's supposedly a very conservative order, you know, the ones that train the young women to be elite. Ascension, is that an order of nuns? I don't know, some of you probably know. Anyway, and they were running a little cooperative where they were trying to get peasants together to, you know, build a well or to, be willing to have injections or to work together on things. It was very impressive. And that kind of space was left. People could do it. If you tried to do it in El Salvador, you get murdered. In Nicaragua, you could do it. And that was a good thing. And a lot of things happened. But I don't think you can attribute it to the leadership. To the extent to which the leadership was mired in corruption was not entirely visible in the 80s because you couldn't see how much of it was private robbery and how much it was just being in power. It became very clear after 1990 and not very pleasant. And furthermore, it's a typical phenomenon. You know, it's a very typical phenomenon of sort of semi-colonial societies. It's also typical in our own society. You take a look at what happens in really repressed areas, you often see something quite similar. I don't have to give you examples. You know them. And it's understandable. You know, it's not pretty, but it's understandable. When people are really under the boot, that's the kind of thing that happens. The responsibility is here, not there.
Does language have anything to do with all this? Is English the language of control of the world?
But that's just a reflection.
In South America, where they speak Spanish and the indigenous people speak something else, it seems the Spanish are in control. Yeah. What is the part of language?
Well, I think... I mean, there's an interaction, but basically it's a reflection of power. You know, the power, the dominant language is a reflection of other power. It does then feed back into it, the way you say these things do interact. So, yeah, English is the language of world, you know, it's the dominant language in the world because England was the most violent and brutal country in the world, you know, and conquered most of the world. In fact, that's why we're here, you know. Like, what happened to the people who were here? You know, okay, we know what happened to them. That's because the English colonists just wiped them out, you know. We're able to do pretty much the same in most of the world. They're not alone, like the French in West Africa have a monstrous record, which goes right up to this moment. You know, they're deeply involved in the atrocities in Algeria, for example. And the rest of the countries have a horrible record, too, but the English were the most successful. England and its colonies, the United States, England and the United States, its former colony, I mean, those are the only countries, major countries, that have never suffered a defeat. Take a look at their history in the last couple hundred years. They have never been defeated. The United States has never even been threatened. You know, England has been threatened, but not defeated. When countries are that successful, the results are not pretty. And one of them is the dominance of the language, but that's a reflection, not a cause.
Just got a mic, so we can record your question.
What if I speak loud?
Yeah.
Professor Chomsky, what's the function of incarceration right now, and why is the ruling class locking up so many poor people?
Well, you can, I mean, a good guess as to the answer comes from the timing. So this process of, by now, as everybody here knows, the United States is just off the world spectrum on this. It's like 5 to 10 times as high as any other industrial country, and I think probably world champion by now in per capita incarceration. And it has nothing to do with crime. You know, I mean, the U.S. has been, if you take a look at other comparable societies like 20 years ago, the U.S. was sort of toward the high end, but not off the spectrum. And that remains true. Nothing's changed. So it has nothing to do with crime. What has happened in the last 20, 25 years? Well, what's happened, what the most striking thing that's happened is what I've just been discussing. Neoliberal reforms and the counterattack against the democratizing, civilizing tendencies of the 60s and later. There's been a major attack. I discussed a number of them, and this happens to coincide with it. It's from the late 70s, you know, when the Reagan programs were actually instituted in the late Carter years and then intensified under Reagan. During that period, that's the period when incarceration goes up. And we all know how it goes up. Yeah, it goes up by inventing crimes, mostly victimless crimes. So if a kid in Roxbury is found with a joint in his pocket, you know, end up in jail for years. And notice these are very carefully crafted crimes. Like, for example, the peak use of marijuana, I think, was about late 70s sometime. But that was a low point in incarceration. And the reason is, you know, it was folks like us, you know, like our children. You don't go and throw them in jail. Just like you don't go to the suburb where I live in Boston and go into somebody's home and take out an executive who's snorting coke and throw him in jail. In fact, the police tried to do that, they'd be in jail, you know. But if you go down to the slums downtown, yeah, sure, then you can do it, and it's easy, and, you know, it's nothing. And that's the way you control what have been always been called the dangerous classes. The neoliberal period has one of its properties is it makes a lot of people superfluous. You know, for most of the population, wages and incomes kind of stagnate. Incomes kind of are maintained, but that's because working hours are going way up. The U.S. has by far the highest workload in the world by now, past Japan a couple of years ago. But so you can maintain, you know, you can maintain incomes by very intensive work, but benefits have declined, support systems were always weak and have declined, wages are declining, and for the poor are actually declining. And many people, there's just no place for them. What do you do with them? Throw them in jail. It has many advantages. For one thing, it gets rid of people, you know, anything to do with. People are superfluous. For another thing, it's a very good way of frightening everybody else. So fear of crime is very high in the United States. Crime is not very high, but fear of crime is very high. And stimulated, artificially stimulated. The United States is one of the very, maybe the only country where being tough on criminals is an important feature of running for office. Most places, crime exists, considered a problem. You know, it's a problem you try to deal with humanely. Here, it's something that you use to show how tough you are. It's just like having the death sentence, which is considered an abomination in virtually the entire world. And all of these are very carefully focused. They're focused on the dangerous classes. The people who are superfluous, everybody else gets frightened, it increases racism and tension, has lots of helpful benefits. It's even an economic benefit. So by now, the scale of what Randy Sheldon and others have called the crime control industry, the scale of it is, it's not the Pentagon, you know, but it's substantial. It's a substantial industry that even interests high-tech industry. Because they can produce, you know, complicated high-tech surveillance devices and things. It interests the major financial institutions because they can float big loans for prison construction. It's a big employer. In fact, if we were there has just been a little while ago the first major study I've ever seen of the effect of incarceration on employment. It turns out. You take these 2 million people who are in jail, mostly, you know, overwhelmingly black males of working age. You know, it's a workforce. I suppose you put them, you count them back in the workforce. Well, you know, U.S. unemployment rates go up almost 2%. Already, contrary to a lot of fabrication, U.S. unemployment rates are not very different from, say, Western Europe. They're a little lower, but not very much lower. They're within the spectrum. You add this in, they're very well within the range of other countries. And that's an underestimate, because that's only counting the prisoners. Suppose you count the rest of the, what's ludicrously called the criminal justice system. If you count the rest of it, you know, the guards, the police, the lawyers, the judges, you know, that whole huge apparatus, well, that's a large number of people taken away from productive occupations. If you count them as unemployed, I mean, they ought to be counted as negatively employed if there were such a measure, but if you count them as unemployed, which would at least be fair, then, you know, you have a pretty high unemployment in the United States. But this is kind of masked, you know. From many points of view, it's highly effective. I can't see any other reason for it. It certainly has nothing to do with dealing with crime. It's kind of like the bombing peasants in Colombia. It has nothing to do with producing, you know, dealing with drugs in the United States. I mean, nothing whatsoever. Everybody knows it. It's a modality of counterinsurgency. Here, it's our domestic version, population control. If there's another reason, I can't figure out what it is. Furthermore, it's understood. You know, like when the drug war was, the last phase of the drug war was called about 15 years ago, in the late 80s, there is one senator, and not my favorite person, but he does pay attention to social statistics, Daniel Moynihan. He, social science, he pointed out right away. He said, look, if we pass this drug law, we are deciding to have a crime wave among minorities. And it was clear. You know, you just take a look at the social statistics and think about how policing works. Yeah, it's exactly what they were deciding to do. It's exactly what they did do. Generated a crime wave and then imposed harsh penalties for the crimes that were invented.
What do you see as a possibility for empowerment of the minorities through the normal political process, voter registration and general awareness raising?
Well, for one thing, I think we should bear in mind that it's the empowerment of the majority that we should be concerned with. It's the majority of the population that's out of the system. You know, it's over half the population who says they feel powerless. Okay. It's 75% of the population who say the elections don't have anything to do with them. You know, the big question is, what about empowerment of the majority? And in fact, all the measures that I've been talking about are efforts to, I think, should be understood as efforts to disempower the majority while maintaining formal processes of electoral function. But you're right, the more deprived sectors of the population are the most disempowered, as you'd expect. So, I'm sure you all know, but one of the effects of the incarceration, just the incarceration alone, which is very racially tainted, you know, we all know that. One of the effects is to disenfranchise very large numbers of black voters, mostly men, but increasingly women. During the Clinton-Gore years alone, about 600,000 more people were put in jail. That's approximately a little over almost a third of the total number now. Those people are disenfranchised while they're in jail, and because of the, you know, crazed punitive elements of the U.S. system, many of them are disenfranchised forever. Well, those votes alone, since they overwhelmingly vote Democratic, would have easily swung the election to the Democrats. But they preferred to throw people in jail rather than to win the election. In Florida, in Florida alone, you know, just the prison, forgetting all the illegal, you know, keeping people off the lists and all this kind of crazy stuff, forgetting all of that stuff, just the straight incarceration was enough to swing the election. So that's a pretty core element of disempowerment, and it goes well beyond that because it shows up in everything else. You know, like if you're living in under conditions of deprivation and impoverishment, and if you don't have an organized basis to resist, like you don't have labor unions, you know, militant labor unions and other popular organizations that enable poor people to resist, Yeah, then you're disempowered, even if you're allowed to push a button once every couple of years. You have nothing to do with what's happening. You know, and people know it.
We have two people in 28.
Oh, sorry.
I'm interested to hear what your thoughts and feelings are about the emergence of a new mass activist movement that we saw in Seattle and Washington, Quebec. What your thoughts of it, given everything that you've been talking about, and in particular, what things you think would be very strategic to focus on for this movement. And then secondly, I'd be interested if you could hear your thoughts on the growing corporatization, well, centralization and control of media in this country. And in particular, in the context of that, the fight, if you could talk a little bit about the fight at Pacifica Radio to maintain a progressive voice in media.
Well, I mean, the popular movements, for one thing, we should bear in mind that we have a slightly skewed picture of them here. They've been going on a massive scale in the third world for years. I mean, that doesn't really break through to consciousness here, but if you take a look at India and Brazil and places like that, they've got huge mass movements, which have been very active and effective. I mean, the reason the World Social Forum was held in Porto Alegre in Brazil is because that's an area of Brazil that has been under the political leadership of the Workers' Party, you know, the biggest social democratic labor-based party in the world and the most militant one for years. The landless workers movement in Brazil has hundreds of thousands of people who take land. You know, they're a very serious movement, one of the most important, maybe the most important popular movement in the world. In India, there have been huge demonstrations against World Trade Organization rules and others, major strikes and so on. That stuff never kind of reaches the consciousness of the North, because just, you know, a lot of those poor people. But when it gets to something like Seattle, then, yeah, it gets into consciousness. Then you get, it's happening right here, so can't ignore it. And what was, it had already reached the consciousness of the business world a couple of years earlier, when the mass popular movements were able to beat back the Multilateral Agreement on Investment in 1998. That was a major victory. You know, it wasn't talked about in public much, except in the business press, but it was really striking how activists around the world without any resources or organization were able to beat back the most powerful concentration, the greatest concentration of power in world history, which is trying to ram through an investor rights agreement. They had to back off. They're now trying to sneak it back in the FTAA and other things. And now, yes, this, from in the major public demonstrations, it's just impossible to ignore. So as I mentioned, in Quebec, it was the first time that the free trade area of the Americas ever did reach, you know, a minimal amount of public awareness. Of course, it's still totally distorted and mostly secret, but something at least. Yeah, these popular movements are, you know, that's the way people respond to repression correctly, and it's the right way to do it. And they can have a huge effect. There is repression, like, you know, wasn't pleasant to be in the streets of Seattle or Quebec, but, you know, as compared with what most people in the world face, you know, it's not a lot. And for people like us here, you know, people with any degree of privilege in the West, it's very limited repression by comparative standards. So you have an enormous amount of freedom to do things, and you know, it should be, this country should be an organizer's paradise. You have a country where most of the population feels powerless. Most of the population feels repressed. You know, that's just a paradise for organizers, for people who want to educate and organize. They ought to become a force which can take over take over power and impose their own conditions. Of course, it has to happen. You know, and it doesn't happen by magic. It happens by hard work. What are the issues that ought to be focused on? I mean, there are a lot of them. I mentioned the FTAA, but it's not the only one. I mean, there is an attempt right here to dismantle just about every achievement of rights that has been gained. So let's take Social Security. Nobody's in doubt at the moment that there's an effort to dismantle the Social Security system, and it's again bipartisan. And it's understood why. The Social Security, if you can dismantle Social Security, for one thing, it's a huge bonanza for Wall Street. That means trillions of dollars for Wall Street managers to play around with. But I know that's discussed. I think there are more important reasons. I mean, there is, in the back of it, a scam, pure scam, about a Social Security crisis. I mean, I don't have to bother talking about it. It's complete fabrication. And if, to the extent there was any problem, there are trivial ways of dealing with it, and there isn't a problem. But the reasons for it are pretty deep, I think. So if you just think about the consequences of privatizing Social Security, one consequence is that it turns working people into, it forces working people to be opposed to their own interests. Very strikingly. If your future, you know, your security for the future depends on the stock market, you must be in favor of anti-labor measures and measures to destroy the environment and anything else that's going to raise stock prices. You have to be. You have to be dedicated to opposing your own interests and the interests of your grandchildren, say, because that's what environmental issues are about. Now, you know, that's a brilliant technique of social control, to condemn, to force people just to have no choices. You know, to be strongly opposed to their own interests and the interests of their children and their grandchildren. It's pretty hard to think of a better device of social control. And that's privatizing Social Security. That's what it does. Another thing that it does is it undermines this dangerous feeling that people have that they should care about somebody else. Like you should care whether the disabled widow across town has food to eat. Well, that's Social Security. Says you care about that. You're not supposed to care about that. In fact, if you study the ideology, you're supposed to be what's called a rational wealth maximizer, meaning you should only be concerned with maximizing your own commodity consumption, period. That's called being rational. If somebody from Mars was looking at it, they would call it being pathologically insane. You know? But that's what's called rational, and that's what we're taught to be. It's driven into your head from infancy. And things like Social Security they counter that. You know, they're based on the principle that you care about someone else. It's the same flaw that the public school system has. Public school system is based on the idea that you care about whether the kid down the street goes to school. You know, and that's a really bad idea. You know, that's got to be driven out of people's minds, like any normal human sentiment has to be driven out of their minds if they're going to be controlled. I think there are real reasons for these attacks on the public sector. That's why it doesn't really matter if they harm economic growth, as they typically do, because it's not important. There are much more important goals. What should we be doing? Well, you know, countering all of this. And in fact, if you want to privatize some system, there's a standard technique. You want to privatize the railroads in England, the first thing you do is defund them so they're a wreck. You know, and then nobody can stand them anymore. So then you can drive through privatization, and people say, okay. And that's the standard technique for taking anything out of the public arena, the arena of democratic control. Defund it, you know, harm it so it won't work, and then people can't stand it, and we want to get rid of it. Yeah, so same here. Defund the public schools, try to manufacture a Social Security crisis, even though there isn't any. Every area you can think of, health, environment, whatever, that's the way to do it. And then, yeah, people will be willing to say, well, I'll hand it over to some private tyranny. This is exactly what people should what anybody who wants to keep a civilized society should be working against this by the only means there are, by education and organization. There's no other means.
We don't have time anymore.
Don't have any time?
No, we don't. We'd like to thank Noam for coming in and for spending time with us today.